Welcome into another edition of the Dana and Victory podcast, only available on musketeerreport.com. I am Rick. He is Dan. And Dan, it's been a while since we last talked.
That's right. I guess it's been about 3 weeks since we had our last post-game podcast after the Murray State game. I hope everyone had a good Thanksgiving. Musketeers have played five games, actually, so we're not going to belabor each play-by-play too much, but we'll try and deal with sort of the broader strokes that we've seen over the last few weeks and give our thoughts as we head into the end of the non-conference schedule. Musketeers went to the Wooden in Fullerton, California. They defeated San Diego on Thanksgiving Day, 82-71, behind 17 points from Trayvon Blewett, and that ran their record to 5-0. But as things so often happen these holiday tournaments, and we'll talk about this a little bit later, things hit the skids for the Muskies out west. They lost to UTEP in the semifinal of that tournament, 77-73. Really a disappointing second half. Miles Davis led the way, 15 points. Musketeers then on the Sunday then had to play Long Beach State, a team that they'd beaten pretty soundly at Cintas Center a week and a half prior. And LBSU, as you would expect, got their revenge, 73-70. Matt Stainbrook, 19 points, 12 rebounds for the Musketeers, but not a whole lot else worked for the Muskies. However, they have righted the ship somewhat, beating Alabama 97-84 last Saturday night. Miles Davis had 18, but of course, when you score that many points, there was a lot of scoring to go around, a lot to talk about. And then on Tuesday, a sluggish performance in the first half, but they saw off IUPUI 66-43. Trayvon Blewett led the way, 12 points. Musketeers are 7-2. Surprisingly to me, Rick, because I haven't been following the KenPom rankings on a day-to-day basis, the Muskies are 37th in KenPom. I expect them to be significantly lower. And I think a lot of that is because some of the wins that they've had look a little bit better than maybe we anticipated. Stephen F. Austin at 58, Alabama at 69. You have the loss to UTEP, who's 74, I think stronger than maybe we anticipated. And then you look at the two games with Long Beach, the game with San Diego. Those are both teams just on the cusp of the top 100. Musketeers 11th in the nation in offensive efficiency, again, according to KenPom.com, 110.9 points per 100 possessions, which I believe, Rick, it would be the best position they've been in, at least as far as a ranking goes, since the 2008 team, which is probably the best team in Xavier history, at least in my opinion, the 30-7 team. But defense has been a problem, 111th in the country, and that was pretty evident in the two losses in California and then in the Alabama game the following week. So, Rick, there's a lot of places we could start with this. I think we have to start, though, with, you know, we've been so positive and upbeat after those first four games, but I think everybody knew that a team this young was going to have some warts at some point, and I think that those have become evident over the last couple weeks. So maybe we can start off with talking about some of the things that haven't gone well for the Muskies and then hit some of the positives.
Yep. First of all, let's just start at the basics. You know, you said Xavier's ranked 37th by KenPom. Right now, that places them in fifth, according to his rankings, in the Big East. Villanova is sixth, Georgetown's 22nd, St. John's is 26th, and Butler is 27th. So, obviously, the Big East has done really well to start. But one of the things you look at when, you know, we've talked so much about this Xavier non-conference schedule and how it was kind of weaker this year, yes, some of those wins have ended up looking a little bit better on paper, but still taking the two losses that they took, they're a team that didn't give themselves a lot of wiggle room. How do you worry about how much this is going to hurt them down the stretch? I mean, because obviously the Big East is looking pretty strong, stronger than many anticipated. I don't think this team's going to just roll through the Big East. They're going to have several losses there as well. So, you know, does it concern you that even if they don't pick up any more non-conference losses, that these two will cost them because of who it was against?
I actually don't think so. And let me say why I believe that way. First of all, I think Stephen F. Austin is going to win 28 games this year. And so they're going to continue to be a real strong, and they're going to blow out most of the teams in the Southland Conference. Right. So that's going to, their KenPom is going to remain pretty high up. And I actually think that Alabama team is pretty good. And the SEC, at least once you get past Kentucky, is absolutely atrocious. So that's a team that could be pretty respectable as well. And UTEP, to be perfectly honest, they look like a pretty good basketball team to me. That looked like a team that can get some wins going through their conference schedule. So I think there are a few teams on this non-conference slate that have relatively high ceilings. And I guess that if there is a positive, it's a positive and a negative. It's that a couple of the teams that we didn't necessarily expect in the Big East Conference to be good this year have been very good so far. And I think specifically of Butler, yeah, Creighton, and Seton Hall, all of whom have been fantastic. I think all of them have at one time or another received. Butler is ranked. Creighton was receiving votes. They were ranked. I think they're now receiving votes. Seton Hall's gotten some national pub. You think about Georgetown, who's been in and out of the polls. And then, of course, Villanova is one of the best teams in the country. So you start from there. Providence even has had some nice wins, although they've had a rough spell this past week. I mean, they're at least right now, there are seven teams in the Big East that are pretty well positioned to fight for NCAA tournament spots. What that means is you're going to get lots and lots of opportunities for resume enhancing wins. And I think this is one of those years where if Xavier can go above 500 in the conference schedule, maybe pick up a couple of those big wins, maybe get a couple wins on the road, they should be okay.
KenPom has them projected to go 10-8 in conference, by the way.
Yeah, would that be enough? I mean, assuming they beat, but he's got them losing to UC. I feel like if they went 10-8 in the conference and beat UC, won the rest of their non-conference games, I'd feel pretty good about 20-11 against this schedule.
Sure,
but you know, it's going to be a tough road to get there. I mean, as you say, there are so many good teams in the league this year. But I guess the most puzzling thing about this, Rick, and I don't know if there's an explanation for it, but this is Chris Mack's sixth year at Xavier. X has played in one of these exempt tournaments each year of his tenure. X 7-11 in those games, and they don't have any good wins. I went back through and looked at the actual game by game results in these tournaments, and I think the only win over those 6 years that you could even count, you could even maybe count as a good win, was when X beat Iowa to Holloway's junior year on the way to that 15-1 A-10 record that season. And right, Iowa was at best a fringe NCAA. I think they made the NIT that year. Then you look at the negative side of the ledger, and some of the worst losses Xavier has suffered during the Chris Mack era have come in these tournaments. You think, obviously, Pacific. Immediately Pacific's bad, but that was a bad Xavier team. I think True. Of that Hawaii game.
Yeah, Hawaii was awful.
Which was a disastrous loss, and then maybe the worst one of all in terms of the way the selection committee considered it was the USC game.
I was just going to say that might be the most damaging loss that they've suffered.
In fact, this is a little bit inside baseball because I don't think it was part of the podcast we actually posted. But when we talked to Mario Mercurio last season after the selection show, he told us that he thought the USC game, that if Xavier had won that game, they would have been safely out of the playing game and off the bubble.
Yep.
And because they had lost that game, that was a point of emphasis for the committee because they took such a bad loss to such a bad team. So when you look at this, I mean, what is there an explanation, or is it just something new every year?
That's the hard thing to reconcile, because at some point it's like, okay, well, what's the issue? Why is it's this group, right? I mean, they didn't have these issues when Sean Miller was coaching them, and it's not like other teams. You can say it's tough to win on the road, and that's true, but it's not like every other team goes and loses at these neutral site tournaments, because someone's obviously winning them. And if Xavier wants to be considered a good team, why can they not win in those situations? It's certainly a question to ask. I think one of the things you do have to look at is that Chris Mack has been dealt some interesting circumstances since he's been here. I mean, you look at some of the teams that in a lot of cases, it's always felt like he's been scrambling a little bit at the beginning of the year to put together a roster, whether they've had to do it with guys transferring out and they're bringing playing on, you know, a guy like Travis Taylor or an Isaiah Fillmore and Andre Walker as a transfer in, and they're playing a very important role early on, and it takes them a while to figure things out and get in the flow, or whether it's like Brian Snow mentioned, the first year when you had Jordan Crawford and you were trying to implement him into a team with Tu Holloway and figure out what the best way to play was with them and Kenny Freeze.
In fairness, in that tournament, though, that one was kind of one of the ones that was understandable.
Right, you lost to Marquette.
Good Marquette team and a top 10 Baylor team.
I mean, just speaking from a standpoint of, you know, then you lose Des Wells and you've got to figure out right. What you're doing the next year. So there's been some issues, I think, at the beginning of seasons and some uncertainty, and it's taken his teams a while to figure themselves out. So I do think that may be part of it. But the other thing, I mean, what else do you point to? Just mental toughness? Is there an issue there? Like, I mean, we follow CJ Anderson's Twitter account. Obviously, he's always preaching that about the last few teams that Chris Mack has coached. I can't put a finger on it because each year I look and it seems like it's been different issues. And even game to game, there's been different issues. Like this year, I thought, you know, everyone's pointing to the defense and certainly it was bad, but the problem was they didn't make shots. And in some cases it was missed threes. In some cases it was missed layups. I mean, what do you say to that? What is the problem there? You know what I mean? Like if you're getting a good look and you're missing a layup, what's the issue? I don't know how to quantify that or who to put that on other than guys not executing. If it's that he needs to figure out a way to get his teams to be mentally tougher in these early neutral site tournaments, then so be it. But I just don't know what the solution to that is.
Yeah, I mean, the UTEP game in particular was befuddling. Actually, the UTEP and the Long Beach State game, if you think about it, kind of followed a similar pattern. In both games, the opposing team came out really flat, and yeah. Xavier was not great. They weren't as good as they were. They didn't have the efficiency level they had in those first four games at home.
Well, the difference is they didn't score. They right. played as just as well defensively, if not better, in the first half of those two games, and ended up with leads in them, slight leads, but leads.
But in both of those games, they had opportunities to extend leads to double digits right. and take double digit leads into halftime. And in both cases, they were unable to do that. The UTEP game in particular, they had a very fortunate. They had a couple fortunate calls go their way. Vince Hunter, who's one of the most important players on that team, has three fouls with, I think, at the last TV timeout of the first half. And X, you know, in his absence, you know, they can't pull away and they go into half with a 5-point lead. And then two possessions in the second half, it's a tie game. And it's, oh, boy, here we go. But, you know, the difference between the two games, the UTEP game was a really I thought the second half of that game was a really good, scrappy basketball team. A lot of good defense being played by both sides, making some plays. The difference in that game really was the one sort of banked miracle shot three. That UTEP yeah. banked in right off of an obvious travel in the key. One pass before it. You know, you'll have that once or twice a year where you just, you know, circumstances just conspire against you. But for them to be as flat as they were against Long Beach, particularly on defense, was, I think that was kind of, I mean, if you're a coach, that's kind of one of those things that's almost inexcusable. And I saw one of the things being mentioned that, man, Stainbrook looked sluggish, and he did look sluggish in that game, which leads me to the question, why is Xavier practicing twice on Saturday? I mean, there definitely was an energy gap between Xavier and Long Beach in that game. And
yeah.
I can't help but wonder why that is, because honestly, we saw Xavier play Long Beach in Cincinnati. Long Beach is a good team. They have good guards, but they should not have been running circles around Xavier the way they were in the second half of that game. And it was disheartening watching that. It certainly was the worst defense that we've seen Xavier play this year. And as you say, Rick, they compounded that issue. The source of that issue was their inability to finish on the offensive end.
Well, and that's the thing. The thing is, in each of those games, like if you look at those weren't their worst defensive performances of the year at all. I mean, they were average. It was the fourth and fifth worst defensive performances of the season. You know, they weren't good defensively. They certainly gave up way too many open 3-point looks. And in some cases, here was the other thing about the defense. When everyone, you know, it was such a big topic and everyone was like, well, it's the pack line and it's the way they hedge their screens. And in some cases, yes, that is. And that's been certainly an issue with especially bigs that are skilled that can pick and pop, that teams have gotten Xavier with that and the way they hedge their screens literally since, you know, they've been defending that way. That is nothing new. We've fans have complained about that every single year. But the defense in general, there were so many individual breakdowns that it's like it doesn't matter what defense you're in necessarily. Even if you're in a zone, if guys are getting beat the way some of these individuals are getting beat, whether it's Trayvon Blewett, honestly, he's the one where if you go back and look, which I watched the two losses, I watched them extensively and kind of was rewinding plays and breaking it down a little more like film. If you go back and look, he looked exhausted those second two games. He was the one whose energy level, especially on the defensive end and the glass, really dropped. He gave up some offensive putbacks in that second half, especially when he was going up against Vince Hunter, where he was just too lazy to move over and box someone out or too tired to do so. So I think that was an issue. I think Stainbrook looked completely dead. I want to talk about more about him in a second. And then Farr just getting pinned way underneath. Those three were the guys that I thought were the biggest offenders on the defensive end from what I saw. And there's just certain things where if you're going to get beat the way they were getting beat, no defense can fix that. No scheme, no 3-2 zone, no 1-3-1, no full court press. Nothing's going to help if you get beat individually the way they were getting beaten on some of the plays that I saw that they gave up. And that just goes back to what we've talked about. This isn't a very good defensive team. They need to get better. If they don't get better, they're not going to reach their potential. But right now, they're in the process of growing on that end still.
Do you think that as the pack line defense, because when Xavier initially started playing the pack line defense under Sean Miller, they were a relatively early adopter of that philosophy. Obviously it was something that Dick Bennett really was the original
father of, right?
Godfather of that defense. And then his son has played it at Washington State, now Virginia. You know, Sean Miller, his coaching tree, use it for the most part. Do you think that as that pack line defense has become more popular around basketball, that teams have figured out a little bit how to attack it better? Because it seems to me that when I look at the statistics, just the raw statistics, although the 3-point percentage is about the same during the MAC years as the Miller years, teams are taking a ton more 3-point shots against Max teams than against Miller's teams. The percentage of the 3-point attempt percentage has gone up. And Xavier, as we've talked about ad nauseum, particularly not this year quite as badly as the 3 years before it, but Xavier, you know, gave up more 3-point attempts, not necessarily makes, than 90% of Division I in those 3 years.
Right.
And so, I mean, our team's just realizing that, hey, Xavier runs a pretty vanilla pack line. We'll just put our best shooters out there and shoot over the top of it and hope we can make enough to win the game. I mean, is that the philosophy to beat this team at this point?
I think that's certainly part of the game plan. I mean, who isn't trying to do that? You've definitely that's definitely what teams have tried to exploit, is Xavier's perimeter defense. And what we've certainly seen is any team with a skilled four, the pick and pop is something that every team is going to immediately do to Xavier if they have a guy who can do it. And sometimes
and that's
just
something that. And that's been something that X has been getting killed on for years.
Yeah, I mean, that's nothing new. That goes back to Miller even.
Yeah.
So like that's just one of the flaws of the pack line defense. Like every defense gives up something. And, you know, I think their philosophy is how many fours and fives are going to beat you from the outside. Well, that also might be changing a little bit with how we've seen basketball evolve. And you do see the stretch four is so popular now that maybe that's changed a little bit in the last 10 years to where the defense isn't maybe quite as effective as it used to be. And obviously you bring up a good point about the more teams see it, they probably get more comfortable with game planning for it. But I think the biggest issue Xavier has had when defending the perimeter, and the issue that all the fans have, is the way they defend ball screens. It's not necessarily the pack line defense, which is more the way that they help and the rotations that they use out of their base man to man. It's more the way they're defending ball screens and those hard hedges with the bigs, or even when they're not hard hedging, just the owning that they do where the big completely gives up his initial defensive responsibility and becomes a defender of the ball handler. And then it sets you in a scramble situation where everyone is, sort of out of position. And when you had guys like a Kenny Freeze, or you had a Stainbrook and Isaiah Fillmore, or we're seeing this year with Stainbrook, Farr, and Blew it all on the court together, sometimes those slow footed guys maybe don't do as well. But at the same time, sometimes those slow footed guys don't do as well in any defense. So,
well, that's true, but I guess
I think the pack line still works if you run it well, is my point. If you look at
right, no.
Arizona and Virginia, they are still running it very effectively.
Well, and but the other thing is, and this I'll observe about Sean Miller's teams, is that the one thing about the pack line is that it plays the percentages, right? Yep. It's like the guy that always stays on, or that always hits on 16 at the blackjack table, because that's what the card says. Well, you lose sometimes. I mean, yeah. And that's why, you know, all that it takes is one team going nuts from the perimeter, and you know, in an NCAA tournament situation, those teams go out. So, but I guess my thing is, I don't think it's a systemic problem. I do think that, and oh, you're going to hate me for saying this, Rick, I do think that maybe there is an onus on the coaching staff to tweak the pack line to fit the personnel they have, because I don't hate you for saying that at all.
I've been kind of a proponent of that. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I just kind of hate the constant refrain that the reason why Xavier can't defend the perimeter effectively is because, well, we got Matt Stainbrook. Well, we got Kenny Freeze. Well, you know, those guys didn't just drop out of the sky. I mean, they were brought in for a specific reason. So if you feel that you need the traditional sort of slow-footed, back to the basket, good post defender, like those two guys, that the profile that those two guys maybe fit into, well, then maybe you have to change the way you attack defensively to make allowances for that, instead of just jamming, you know, the proverbial square peg into a round hole. And I'll give you an example. I mean, trying to have Isaiah Fillmore play the four in a pack line defense the same way Travis Taylor did the year before, I mean, that's just not going to work. They're two guys with almost diametrically opposed skill sets. Yet last year, it felt like Fillmore was being given that same assignment to really hedge out on screens, to react quickly, to go out to the perimeter to contest shots when the four crept out. And it's just like the guy can't do it. So I do think that there isn't a systemic problem. I don't agree with the people who say, oh, we need to just scrap the pack line. But I am. It does concern me that we continue to keep seeing these issues with the way Xavier executes the pack line that seem to be based on personnel. And it's like, well, they're your guys. You got to figure it out. You know what I'm saying? Does that make sense?
I mean, I don't know. No, I 100% agree. And I've always been a big proponent of you fit what you do as a coach and philosophy to your personnel. That being said, Chris Mack knows a heck of a lot more about basketball than I'll ever know. And I think the staff does a really good job. And I think in a lot of cases they do cater what they do to fit their personnel, especially on the offensive end. I think they do a really good job of that. Defensively, look, I mean, they were around 50 the first 3 years of Chris Mack's tenure.
Yeah, that's
defensively.
That's absolutely true.
They weren't bad in the pack line defense, and I don't think they necessarily had the best personnel. But what they did have is some really tough defensive guards across the board, and they had enough pieces. Now, the last few years, I think there's been some issues with just personnel not getting enough continuity on the court together, to where I don't know if they'd be great at any defense. I don't disagree with you that you can't just keep making excuses and say, well, we can't defend the perimeter because we brought in this personnel and they didn't suit it. You're right.
They're not making the coaching staff is not making those excuses. These are the explanations that you and I and Snow and people observing the team are seeing.
Right.
I guess to me, you have two choices, right? You can do what John Beilein does, and you can recruit guys that fit your system. And if that means taking guys that aren't highly ranked, that's what it means. Because if they're the guy that you can spot that you know is going to work in your system, you take them regardless. And he's been fabulously successful the last week notwithstanding. But John Beilein's a really good coach and obviously has an unbelievably well-honed eye for talent. Most coaches do what Xavier does, do what 90% of programs do. They go out and get the best guys they can. Yeah. And then they figure it out. I guess, and I think Xavier's done a great job during the Chris Mack era of adjusting the offense every year to match the personnel they had. I mean, even when they had, you know, I actually thought they did relatively well Samaje's freshman year for how little offensive talent they had.
Yeah, no question.
And I think generally they've been relatively good at molding that offensive talent and molding the offensive system to do what they did. You know, you remember when they went to the baseline runner offense with Jordan Crawford, then they switched because they had two Holloway and Mark Lyons, two great ball screen guards, and they went to that straight ball screen offense. We saw them with Samaje and D try to spread the floor out, try to change up who was bringing the ball up, try different things. I think they've been very creative and very good about changing up their offense, but I feel like the defense has been a little bit too, and I think Chris even said it after one of the games, they've been a little bit too rigid in their approach. And yeah. I think what we've seen the last two games with X throwing some press in there at given times has been real effective for him.
Well, look, and here's one of the things about defense. It's not real fun to coach at the highest levels of coaching a defense that you don't really believe in or are too familiar with. Chris Mack knows the pack line. He's comfortable with it. He has an answer for every situation. Anything a team does, any action a team runs throughout a game or any set play they come up with and try to run throughout a game, he has an answer when his kids come to the huddle or when they see something and they want to adjust at halftime. He knows how to adjust. He knows what they can do to adjust to it. If you do something you're not as familiar with, I'm not saying they can't learn another defense. I'm not saying they don't know other defenses. They do. But I'm just saying if you don't truly believe in it and you don't have all those answers necessarily, you don't feel nearly as confident in it. I think he feels confident in the pack line. I think he feels confident that he can make his teams better in the pack line. And here's the thing. At the end of the day, you have to look and say there's give and take in anything, okay? Xavier right now, their offense is on kind of a record pace for Xavier teams. Like this, what they're doing offensively, they don't normally do. This is really, really impressive numbers when it comes to their shooting percentages, their effective field goal percentages, their adjusted efficiency. So you're going to give up something defensively when you have all that talent offensively. That's kind of the way things work. Typically, you usually have a strength on one side of the ball and you're usually not as good on the other side. If you do that, Villanova is maybe one of those teams who are the rare exceptions, or Kentucky, you know, those teams that are at the top echelon, but even Kentucky right now is not a good offensive team. So I think that's what, if you look at this team and the two games they lost on that trip are the only non-conference games they lose, they go 10-8. Well, okay, they could have been better defensively. They could have been the 40th best defensive team in the country, according to efficiency. But would they have been 60th in offense and done the same thing? I mean, you know what I mean? Like, there's give and take. Yeah. So if they're still a good team, even not being the best defensive team, then I think it's okay. You know what I mean? Like, I think there is something to be said about the fact that this coach, especially with Travis Steele being one of the main influences on the bench, he's an offensive-minded guy. There's no doubt in my mind. Like, Sean Miller was all about defense, and I understand that, and he wanted athletes to defend. But I think Chris Mack and Travis Steele want that, but they also lean a little more towards, well, we'd really like to have some skilled guys who can shoot. We don't ever want to be in a position of having to play Dante Jackson at point.
Yeah, and I mean, they're the ones that had to watch the team the last 2 years that couldn't score.
Exactly.
I mean, so in any event, I thought you mentioned Matt Stainbrook in California, and you felt like he was kind of, I mean, as good and as important as Matt is for the team, it felt like he really kind of struggled in those two losses and even in the win over San Diego.
I thought so, especially when I went back and watched it and I saw a lot of the defensive breakdowns. And it's like certain things where it's just like, I think Matt looked like he was on the court trying to catch his wind, trying to catch a break, basically, when something was happening, a rotation, a pass. So then all of a sudden he was late to a closeout or a help. And now everyone was late and, you know, a guy pump faked him and on a closeout and went right around him, and it's a straight line drive to the rim, and you can't defend that no matter what defense you're in. So there were some major issues, I thought, with Matt's defense at times. And then there were also times I thought where this team, they're in the game, they're a few possessions away. And now, granted, I don't want to act like he didn't do anything, because there were times where they just threw the ball into him and ran their offense through him most of the weekend. But there were times they threw it into him late in the game, and he did produce with points on in the paint. But there were also times throughout both games where I'm like, they're in this game, it's a one or two possession game. Where is Matt or where is D? Why are they not here right now? Why are they not making the play right now? Why is Matt too tired, or does he look too exhausted to get that hook to go in when it's a 1 point game in the first half and, you know, 2 minutes left or something? Things like that just caught me as like, D and Matt are supposed to be the leaders and kind of the top guys of this team. That's when you need them in those close ball games, in those moments. He can't be too tired to play. When they get to the Big East tournament and they have to play back-to-back days, Matt can't be too tired in those games to finish. He just can't, and he can't be too tired to play defense. He has to bring it at both ends. And so I think that is a legitimate concern because, you know, obviously last year he was injured going into the Big East tournament. That was a major issue. We saw he really didn't come back very well after playing pretty well in the first game on that bum knee. He didn't come back well at all. So I think that's what you have to look at going forward is there a major issue when they get to tournament time with being able to rely on Stainbrook?
Sure.
Or do you need to do things to save that? Do you need to think ahead and be a little more proactive? Does he need to play less minutes in these games? Should he only be playing 20 minutes a game?
With the
big man rotation that you've got?
I think that's a very valid question. I do. Moving on to the other sort of senior leader on this team, D. Davis. I mean, obviously, look, I think it's obvious by this point that D. Davis is going to be the lightning rod for criticism around the team from, you know, the fans or even the talking heads and so forth. But I do think that some of the criticism is warranted because it seems like he has like three moments in every game where he convinces himself he's Samaje Christen. And in the IUPUI game, especially in the first half, he just seemed to be playing completely out of control, which is the opposite of what you want from D. Davis. I would rather see D. Davis play a very risk-averse offensive game to be more concerned with distributing, with moving the ball around, you know, take
just
a couple
say it. You want a game manager, Dan. You want a game manager. Just say it. He's not an elite quarterback.
No, I absolutely. I think that's his role. I really do. And in the second half, when he did pull back on the reins a little bit, because here's the thing, this Xavier team, unlike previous Xavier teams, has guys that can attack and transition effectively. Yep. You got Remy Abel, you got Trayvon Blewett. D. Davis is not good in transition because he gets himself too far under the basket and he can't get his shot up against bigger players. And for whatever reason this year, the refs aren't giving him anything underneath. I mean, you think about him, and granted, Tu Holloway was taller, but Tu Holloway was a master of getting inside against guys who were 6, 7, 8 inches taller than him, somehow getting his shot to the rim and getting the call, regardless of whether he was anywhere close. D. Davis just doesn't have that ability.
Right.
And it seems like every time he gets into the key, you just sort of go, uh-oh. Because he's trying to get a shot up and it's not going to go well. And I think – and I also think that his defensive performance – and I may be wrong on this and feel free to correct me. I have not been nearly as impressed with his defense this year as I was last year. I think he's taken a pretty significant step back, and I kind of wonder if that's because we underrated Samaje Christen's defense. But I think so far it's been, you know, D's been kind of up and down, and Xavier really needs better returns from him as the schedule gets tougher, especially these next two games, because they're playing Missouri and Auburn, both bad teams, but they're playing them on the road and they're going to play them in empty gyms because both of those are SEC schools now. And, you know, nobody really cares about basketball until after the bowls are over. But I mean, he's got to be the steady hand on the tiller for these young guys. And watching that IUPUI game, I was like, he does not look like the steady hand on the tiller to me.
In my opinion, the first 20 minutes of the IUPUI game were the worst 20 minutes he's played all year. People have complained a lot about some of these other games and the losses and the games in the tournament, but those were the worst 20 minutes I've seen from him all year, where there were no redeeming qualities. Like, that's the thing I've seen in all the other games, where everyone complains about all these three bad mistakes he had throughout the game. Like, there's 12 other things that he did that were really good. And I'm not just talking assists. Like, he's made some really big plays where they be straight line drives to the rim against defenses that weren't doing a good job of defending in transition. Like, I get he's not great in transition, but there's also times where he's had straight line drives to the rim in important situations for Xavier that he got layups off of and finished. So he's had some really good plays in those other games. IUPUI, there were no good plays in the first half out of D. Davis from what I saw. And I think Chris Mack kind of insinuated the same thing in the postgame press conference, that, you know, the tone that D set was just awful. And look, I have to say, the bashing of D is just so over the top from the fan base. But at the same time, he doesn't make it easy on anyone to defend him, because there are the everything you're saying is right. Like, you're not overboard at all with what you just said. There's other opinions that are. There's other people that see it, like I mentioned, in that Andy Dalton lens, where now every single mistake that he makes gets blown up to being such a big deal, when it's like, okay, everyone on the team has made a mistake this game. He's made the least amount of them, and yet you're acting like his were more important than anyone else's. That doesn't make a lot of sense. But I get it. I get the issues. He has to be better. Part of the thing is, I do think Remy Abel has taken some of the one-on-one matchups that D took in the past. I think Remy's guarded some of the other team's best players, whereas D would have taken that role in like a Kellen Dunham situation. I assume Remy will definitely guard him now instead of D having to guard him. So we probably won't point out what a great job D did defensively in that one-on-one matchup now, because Remy's guarding him. I think that's part of what we've seen in the first couple games. You know, some of these guys have been going off and we're like, Remy looks great. Well, Remy's sometimes the guy guarding these dudes going off too. So There are some issues with the entire defense. It's I think it's more of a team issue right now than D, but I think the fact that the team isn't together and on the same page yet has subtracted from everyone's individual performance, including D's. So I don't think you're wrong in saying that he hasn't been quite as effective on the defensive end either as he's been in years past. So No, I was just going to say, the biggest thing is they just need more out of D and Matt. There's no question about that. Those two have to be better. And that's those, along with, I'd say, Jalen Reynolds, have been the two biggest disappointments for me so far this year.
And talk about Jalen a little bit, because it just seems like it's so strange, because when you watch him play, You see so much of the potential. You'll see him grab, you know, a big boy rebound, or against Alabama, where he went through that period where he just kept getting the ball off the floor and dunking it, regardless of who was in his way. But then against IUPUI, he was super passive. He never really was a part of the game. In a game like the, you know, like that UTEP game in the second half, that should be the kind of game that Jalen Reynolds ought to really excel in, because it was a game meant for guys like Jalen Reynolds. That game was typified by guys running the floor, you know, rim running big men. UTEP certainly has their share, and he just struggles to make an impact. And I just don't, you wonder whether it's a problem of not being totally confident in the system, or if, you know, he's not getting enough playing time, or I don't know what the answer is, but certainly he's a guy that Xavier needs to make that step up this season.
I think when we see Jalen Reynolds at his best, and you get those feelings of how is this guy not going to dominate? I mean, he can do everything, and he's such an athletic freak, is when he doesn't have to think, is when we're at Stavros Summer League, or we're in an open gym setting, or we're in pre-Brazil practice, where things are very vanilla.
Or Xavier is playing St. John's, who is effectively an AAU
perfect
team.
Perfect example. Until he gets to the point where he doesn't have to think about what he's doing out on the court, on the defensive end, what he has to do in each screen situation, what he has to do, whether to open up on a dribble handoff or let the guy through, all those different things that he's got to think about right now, I think take away from his production and take away from him just going out and making plays. And until he gets to that point where he's comfortable and he understands what he's doing out there and he doesn't have to think anymore, I don't think he's going to reach that potential. There's going to be the games where I think he explodes, but that's been my biggest disappointment, is I kind of knew coming into the year they wouldn't need him to be the best player on the team every night, because they have Matt, they have Trayvon, they have these other guys. They don't need him to score, you know, go for a double-double every night. But I thought there would be a few games already where he was the best player on the team. I don't think there's been one single game where he's led this team yet. There's been some nice halves that he's put together, nice 7-minute stretches where he's really given them a lift. But I don't think there's been one game where he's been the guy and he's been the best player on the court. And I expected that by now. I expected there would have been a couple games already by now. So disappointment.
That impacts the defense too, because Jalen and James Farr are the only guys on this team that are both rim protectors, theoretically.
Yeah.
And we've seen James do it on occasion. And we'll talk about James when we get to some of the good points, which we need to do because we've talked about the bad ones for half an hour. But Jalen should be a guy that I think you mentioned before the season, Rick, that what Jalen ought to be focusing on this season. Don't worry about scoring. Don't worry about passing the ball that much. Get rebounds and defend effectively. And I don't even know that we've seen that in more than, as you say, sporadic stretches. So,
well, and part of his rebounding numbers are due to the fact that he's not playing as many minutes as you would think. You know, his rebounding rate is pretty darn good, especially when you look at the defensive end. So I'm not going to crush him and act like Jalen isn't producing at all. He's had some great minutes. His offensive rating is high. He's been fairly efficient. He has dunked around the rim enough. He's done some of the things you want to see out of him. I'm just surprised he hasn't made the bigger jump yet.
All right. Well, let's move to the positive side for those of you who haven't driven off the road and into the nearest abutment yet. I think that the first of all, I think it was very impressive the response that Xavier made after the disappointments in California to get two home wins. Granted, the IUPUI game wasn't very impressive, but they beat a pretty good Alabama team, and they did so, I think, with some style. Rick, talk a little bit about the things that you've seen that you're happy with so far this season.
One of the biggest things, you mentioned the bounce back that they had coming out of the tournament. And I do think, do you remember last year, the mood around this team? How it not only looked like they lacked the energy on the court and they struggled to get up for games in the first half and struggled to do just about anything. But in the postgame press conferences, in the pregame press conferences, previewing games, these guys didn't look like, I mean, the feeling in the locker room didn't seem like it was great. There didn't seem to be a lot of confidence. They didn't seem to know what was next for them. This group is the complete opposite. Like, they have so many confident dudes. They're really tight in a group and they're super confident in what they can do. Maybe a little too overconfident, and that's what we saw in the first half of the IUPUI game. But I do think one of the other things that you really have to like is that for the most part, I mentioned their offense struggled a little bit in those two games that they lost, but they've shown that their offensive shooting isn't a fluke. I mean, they rank 11th in the country in offensive efficiency still. Their effective field goal percentage is 58.8, which is 7th in the nation. They're shooting 59.2% on two-pointers, which is 5th in the nation. And then from three-point range, they honestly haven't shot enough threes, in my opinion. They're not getting enough points from the perimeter.
Agreed 100%.
Because they're shooting 38.6%. They've got guys that are stroking it right now. When you talk about JP and Miles and Trayvon, and don't get me wrong, yes, JP's shooting plenty, but they need to shoot more threes, in my opinion. I understand running the offense through Matt. I truly do, and he's going to get guys threes, but in my opinion, I think they'll start to score more from the perimeter as the season goes on.
Here's an interesting thing for you, Rick. The three-point attempt percentage, which is you take the number of threes you shoot divided by the total field goal attempts.
Right.
During Sean Miller's period as Xavier coach, the lowest that Xavier ranked Division I in that statistic was 172. That was his last year. The highest that a Chris Mack team has ever ranked in that category was 181.
Right.
So in other words, the most three-point happy Chris Mack team hasn't even shot as many three-pointers as the most three-point conservative Sean Miller team. And I think that's a problem. I think I honestly think this team needs to shoot more threes.
Well, they haven't had the shooters in the past to do it, but now that's true.
And that's fair. And their three-point shooting percentage is better, but you know, their three-point shooting percentage even the last 2 years wasn't the worst in the world.
Well, it was inflated because they weren't taking shots. I mean, Samaje was shooting like 50% because he shot 14 threes or something. You know, I mean, like, that was a big part of their three-point percentage. That team last year, they had to be creative in how they scored points because they could not make three-point shots.
But team-wide, if you just look at three-point field goal percentage, they were about average last year, 34.8%, 35% the year before, 35.1% the year before that. I mean, that's not great by any stretch of the imagination, but it's not terrible. And it's not a huge gulf from 35% to 38% like they're shooting now.
Well, but
the difference is that this year they're taking more threes. So they're seeing more results from that. But even right now, they're 2-11 in Division I in three point attempt percentage. Granted, some of that is because they played some bad teams that they could just bully inside. But yeah, I think they need to take more threes. I think it should be more of an emphasis in the offensive sets because they've got shooters. They've got shooters all over the floor.
I absolutely agree. I still go back to when you talk about like last year's team, the difference was like they had games where they could make 60%, 70% of their threes and they were hot because Justin Martin and D. Davis made shots or Miles Davis made shots early on. But in the second half of that year, when they were in crucial games, I mean, they were going 0 for 11 for the game from three. I mean, it didn't matter how many they shot. They weren't going to make them because Justin Martin wasn't there and D. Davis wasn't hitting. So and Miles lost all confidence after a certain point. But that's neither here nor there anymore. But I completely agree. More threes is a good thing for this team. I think we'll continue to see that as they go on. I don't think the coaching staff is against it at all. I think right now they're still feeling out how they're going to play. And Matt Stainbrook is a huge part of their offense, what they want to do. So naturally, they've had the ball inside a lot. But, you know, when
Miles Davis, go ahead. You know, is a guy that Miles Davis, a guy that I think has made a huge leap this season from a scoring perspective.
Absolutely. And I mean, the biggest thing I think with him was he going to. Was this going to continue? We saw it the first couple games, but we saw it the first couple games last year. How long? I think with each passing game where he steps back up and he leads the team in scoring again with 18 points, you can take another sigh of relief where it's like, okay, this is who the real Miles Davis was. And last year he was a little bit hurt. You know, I think that was a huge part. The injury and how lacking he was athletically compared to the guys he was playing against really shot his confidence. And this year, I don't think it's near as much of an issue. I think he's playing really well, and that's going to be huge for this team as they get into conference play.
James Farr, I think, has done a really nice job. You know, he had some individual defensive breakdowns in California, but his rebounding effort has been outstanding. And actually, I think one of the big problems that Xavier had in those two losses was that generally they've been a really good offensive rebounding team. And in those two games, their effort was not good on the offensive glass compared to some of the other ones. And you have to wonder if Long Beach in particular kind of challenged their guys because of the way Xavier abused them on the boards in that game. And Long Beach kind of controlled the defensive glass against Xavier.
And that's exactly what I saw.
Game, I should say.
And that's exactly what I saw when I went back and watched it. I watched a Long Beach team. UTEP's just a really good rebounding team anyway. But going back at with Long Beach State, I saw a team that looked completely motivated, that had been looked like they had gotten dominated a couple weeks before on the glass, that wanted and took some pride in the job that they were going to do on that afternoon. And Xavier was the complete opposite. They looked they looked tired. They looked like they didn't care when the shot went up. They just wanted to get a breath. So I completely agree with what you're saying.
It was very similar to the turnaround we saw with Tennessee last year.
Yeah.
Between the loss at Cintas Center and then the kind of beating they put on Xavier at the Atlantis tournament. Of course, that Tennessee team was really good. Long Beach is nowhere near as good a team as Tennessee was last year. But yeah, I mean, it's that there definitely was a difference there. Also, so Rick, a topic that's come up a couple places is shrinking the rotation. The question being asked is, Mac currently playing too many guys? Does he need to cut it down? Who gets dropped out? When's the right time to do so? I mean, do you have a take at this point in the season? Do you think Xavier, it seems to me that Xavier is still very much in information gathering mode, yeah, where when it comes to, you know, playing different combinations of guys. And part of that is just because of the sheer number of newcomers they have this year. It's going to take longer to figure out. But on the other hand, they can't afford to lose any of the next three games. So it's going to have to be there's going to have to be a little bit of tightening of the rotation, I think.
I think that they do have to tighten it up. And I do think part of what's cost them in those close games against the two that they lost against UTEP and Long Beach State was that the combinations that you needed to win you the game in tight moments hadn't spent a ton of time on the floor. And I mean, they hadn't spent any time in those moments, but they're not super familiar with each other yet. Even the D. Davis, Remy Abel, Trayvon Blewett, Matt Stainbrook, James Farr starting lineup isn't super familiar with each other. I mean, they've played enough now, but at that point, I think that cost them in some of those crucial moments. So I do think this is an issue. I think the staff is thinking about it. But at this point, in my opinion, looking at things, do you feel like you confidently know who should and shouldn't be receiving the minutes? I mean, the big rotation I don't think is an issue, because if you know who the three guys are that are going to get the minutes, and Farr and Reynolds are pretty much going to be a game by game scenario, who's playing well and whether Jalen is, you know, is into it or if he's fouling or what the case is. So I don't think that's an issue. But I look at the guards, and I mean, Miles Davis is definitely kind of your next guard in line. But after that, I mean, between Edmund Sumner and Brandon Randolph, or JP McCura, where does he fit in? I'm not real sure that I know how the minutes should shake out yet. I agree. I think they're still in information gathering mode. And here's the thing. You're three games away from playing Georgetown. in conference play, and you're getting into the meat of the schedule. So I don't know when the right time is to make that call and when you have to shorten it. I guess it's something that kind of naturally works itself out, but I can imagine that the staff is definitely doing a lot of thinking about this exact topic and doing a lot of, you know, one of the things we're going to have a guest on in one of these podcasts. We wanted to get him on tonight, but it didn't work out. They are using this lineup analytics program, which does a lot of stats based on the lineups that they have in the game at any given time. And obviously that program means more and more that those stats say a lot more about your team the longer the season goes on and the more information you have to plug in there, because early on in the season you're playing blowouts and you're playing a lot of different combinations out there. So it will be interesting to see what those numbers say over the next few weeks and how that dictates what they do. But I assume this is something they're talking about every day right now.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's no question about it. I think JP McCura is one guy that really is kind of making his case for additional playing time. I thought against IUPUI, he was almost out of control in how much he was trying to show from a defensive standpoint. I think because he understood that he was more athletic than the guys that he was way more athletic than the guys he was guarding, and he might be able to manhandle them a little bit. I think he ended up with 5 steals in that game.
Yeah.
But a lot of them were in kind of comic fashion. McCura, you know, has been such a ball of energy, and he's been so good for this team when he's able, because of his confidence. He's almost the ideal bench player because he really doesn't care. Like, he doesn't have any.
The mistakes do not bother him at all.
No, not at all. A conception of feeling like he's got to come in and be perfect because the coach is going to pull him back out. He'll come in and he'll hoist up a 3 with a hand in his face 2 seconds off the bench, and, you know,
and he'll still shoot the next one.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think McCura has made his case and should be part of the rotation going forward. But the difficulty, Rick, is that you've got, you know, with McKinday out, you've got 12 scholarship guys, you know, Larry Austin, Sean O'Mara, I think are going to be more, you know, break glass in case of emergency guys.
I will say, though,
particularly
Sean O'Mara, he's made you feel pretty good about, man, if Farr twists an ankle or if both of those guys somehow get in foul trouble, you don't feel bad. He can hold his own for 3 minutes
at
the end of the first half or something.
But I think when you're talking about your consistent rotation, you're talking about the other 10 guys. And, I mean, it's tough because Randolph has done a really nice job, I think, running the offense when he's been in there. Miles Davis gives you offense. JP McCurry gives you offense. Sumner is obviously talented. He hits the corner. It reminds me of watching Jalen Marshall at Middletown when he played basketball, Ohio State scat back now, who, you know, he used to, you know, Vince Edwards is his teammate there, would peel off a rebound, hand it off to him, maybe halfway down the court in 2 dribbles, and you'd be like, what the heck happened? And that's the kind of straight line speed that Edmund Sumner has. So he's certainly a fascinating prospect, but I do wonder whether or not he's going to be the guy that kind of fades out of this rotation. And maybe there's a revisiting of that red shirt issue when it comes to the new year.
Well, the only thing about that is he's the one guy I look at, and to me, he's the guy who has upsides, that he brings upside still to this rotation. Whereas I don't know that – I think – you know what? I think Miles is definitely going to give you offense. I don't know that Brandon's been good. I don't want to take away from what he's done, because I think he's been pretty solid and he's played exactly the role they kind of need out of him. But I don't think he gives you any upside to what D gives you. And I think when they've been at their worst, it's usually been when D has come out of the game and Brandon's taken over at the point and they've already kind of been in a funk and he hasn't been able to get them out of that. Edmund's the one guy that they don't really know yet, but might be able to do that, might give them the upside to get them out of those funks at the point guard position, which, let's be honest, we've spent plenty of time talking about tonight. It's one of their bigger issues is the play they're getting at that point guard position. So if Edmund gives them upside there, I don't think they're going to be too anxious to redshirt him. And I think he might earn more minutes, especially. And this is probably the most interesting thing that came out of the IUPUI game to me. The way Edmund showed he could play defense, granted, it wasn't against good players, and he probably knew they weren't going by him to score, but the way he was heating up that 5'7" point guard that they had, who's jet quick, and he had no issues of being able to keep him in front. It was still laterally quick enough to keep him, you know, to keep him there. It was pretty impressive, and that's going to earn him more minutes, I think.
All right, Rick, we're reaching the end of our hour here. big picture, how do you feel about where Xavier stands right now? And what do you see as being the target, say, between now and New Year's Eve against Georgetown?
Snow posted this, and I this sums up exactly where I'm kind of at with this team. He said, this year reminds me so much of Mac's first year. In Mac's first year, they looked great before Orlando, bad in Orlando. Much of the same can be said about this year, substitute Orlando for Anaheim. Half the reason why Xavier struggled at the beginning of Mac's first year is because the coaches had to have time to figure out the best system and the best way to coach the talent they had. Much is the same this year. How do they best use Blewett? How fast do you have to play? Defensively, what is the best way to hide Stainbrook? What are the best combinations and all that stuff? It's exactly what we've been talking about this time. I think a lot of what we've seen so far has been the coaches gathering information, figuring out how they need to play, figuring out how they want to play. Will they make the proper adjustments? It remains to be seen. But I think everyone would agree that this team has a lot of talent. And I think right now they're in a good place. I mentioned the feel of the locker room. I think that's important right now because it's not a young team that was discouraged or soured by the experience they had in Anaheim. Like, I think maybe the team that didn't have many vocal leaders that was led by Smaje Kristen the last few years did struggle after they suffered those losses and kind of have had a dip in performance after that. So I expect them to finish out 3-0 in these next three games before they head into Georgetown. And then that Georgetown game is going to be very interesting at home. Georgetown had an opportunity and almost pulled off the upset at Kansas last night.
Yeah, and they certainly are a team that is very talented and has a lot of complementary pieces. I guess I'm about in the same place you are, Rick. I mean, I feel like, you know, if Xavier had beaten UTEP, and then even if they'd gotten just chewed by Washington in the final of that tournament, I would feel like 150% better about this team. And I can't really figure out why, because really that's not that. The margins there really aren't that great. It's unfortunate because I feel like this is a team that is going to have growing pains. And because they've lost a couple of games already that are not going to say they look pretty in March, I worry a little bit that even if they do progress a little bit, that they don't really have any margin for error to lose any more non-conference games, except maybe at UC if the Big East schedule is going really well. And if they do and they have to go into Big East play and they're kind of playing from behind, I'll tell you what, the Big East looks a lot more daunting for this Xavier team, I think, than I thought it was going to be a month ago.
Absolutely.
So I would say that I'm still a buy on this Xavier team, but I'm not Jim Cramer pulling what's left of my hair out and pushing buttons and making funny noises. I think that they're going to have a good season. I think they've got a very talented team, but there's a lot of work to be done.
Well, and it's important to remember that we expected that coming in. I mean, this is a team that we thought was a year away. You know, right. we didn't think it was quite there. This team is built for the future. They've got so much talent. I think they're moving in the right direction. It's going to be really interesting to see what happens once conference play starts. But I think they're good for the next three games.
By the way, nice scoop by Dana O'Neill getting the exclusive on Matt Stainbrook as an Uber driver only 8 weeks after Shannon wrote a feature on it in the Enquirer.
Is that not a little bit annoying? Like, just like how many people keep talking about that in every game and act like, you know what I mean? And no one mentions the fact that Shannon wrote about it.
I know.
Like, no one brings that up while they're talking about it all game long. And it's like, it's growing a little old, but you know, I mean, it's a cool story.
Aggravating for me. Yeah. I mean, I think it's hilarious, but
I am annoyed by the whole thing with Shannon. Who would you, let me ask you real quick before we sign off, who would you, player on this team or historical Xavier player, who would you most want to be driven around by in an Uber situation?
Wow.
Or would least like to be picked up by, maybe, is a better question. I don't know.
I feel like I would have the most fun if I got picked up by CJ Anderson in an Uber. But
Your lawyer buddies on speed dial for that one.
in terms of a positive experience, I mean, I think that I think it'd be nice to have like a You know, certainly if David West was your Uber driver and you were in a lot of traffic, you know, you would get to your location way faster than you had any business doing it, because he'd be bumping up against everybody.
Yeah.
And getting real aggressive.
And plus he'd give you his political takes.
You wouldn't have to listen to NPR, because Dave could just give you he could just talk extemporaneously. So I would say I would take David West if I had a lot of traffic, and CJ Anderson if it was like a Friday night and I was going out and, you know, wanted to get a good start to the night.
Yeah, no, I think those are pretty good selections. I think Matt Stainbrook is probably the best at the job out of any Xavier players that I've been around. He's probably the one that would do the best. If Uber called me up and was like, hey, we're sorting through applications, which Xavier player should we take? I think Matt Stainbrook would be the one I recommend. I mean, in terms of overall disposition and ability to converse about just about anything, and a kind of a quirky guy, I think
well
he'd be
dressed.
The best one. Yeah,
well,
I mean, I'm sure
professionally
he
dressed.
Shows up in a bow tie and a driver's cap. That'd be nice.
Maybe some gloves, a scarf. Yeah. Yeah, probably all those things. All right. Well, Rick, we won't talk about the Reds trading away their whole team today.
Oh, so, Jordan Crawford update. Five games in, he's averaging 29.4 points in 33.6 minutes per game. He's taking 22 shots per game in those 33 minutes while making 45.5% of them, which only tells me one thing, Dan. He needs to shoot a hell of a lot more.
I think so. I think he needs to. I think he just needs to pick a quarter of each game where he never crosses half court.
Yeah. 3.4 assists is a little bit too unselfish for my liking.
Yeah, I mean, what? Who is he playing with? Andre Blatch or something like
that?
Yeah,
the Zhang Flying Tigers. But I think Blatch is already out of the rotation. He might be off the team by now. They dropped him like right away. He started initially, and then he was out of the rotation by game two.
They'll probably sign Dennis Rodman or something like that next week to mix it up. All right. Well, I think that does it for us. So X plays Missouri on Saturday afternoon, 4:00 Eastern, I believe. And then they're off all the next week, I assume, for exams. Before taking on Auburn, also a road game. I believe that's also a Saturday afternoon game, I think 6 p.m. For that one. So it's going to be pretty slow the next couple weeks, but that's good. Festive period. And hopefully it'll give the coaches an opportunity to do some of that stuff we were talking about today with figuring out the rotation, because it is not an easy task given the multitude of players they've got on this team that are earning playing time.
No, it's not. All right. Well, that does it for this edition of the Dayton and Victory podcast. For Dan, I'm Rick. Thanks for listening, everyone.